Support for NPR and the following message come from PBS. PBS invites you on a trip to the future. A Brief History of the Future is a groundbreaking series about people's futures and how they can be reimagined. A Brief History of the Future. Stream now on PBS and the PBS app.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Like everyone who introduces my guest, I'll start by telling you that he's famous as the hot priest in the award-winning comedy series Fleabag. That priest is torn between his vow of celibacy and his love for a woman who loves him. It was a lot more than Andrew Scott's looks that made him a standout. He is a magnetic and subtle actor, whether his character is delightful or a sociopath. Scott first became known in the U.S. for his role in the British series Sherlock, which starred Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock Holmes and Andrew Scott as his nemesis, Moriarty. A famous film you probably don't remember him in is Steven Spielberg's World War II film Saving Private Ryan, where Scott played the role of Soldier on the Beach, one of the many soldiers on the beach in the film who landed on the Normandy beach on D-Day. Scott returned to World War II with Steven Spielberg in the series Band of Brothers. After doing a share of suffering and World War II stories, he played a burned-out, cynical, wisecracking lieutenant in the World War I film, 1917. Recently, he won British and American acting awards, including a National Society of Film Critics Award for his role in the very quiet film All of Us Strangers, about a gay man who shut down his emotions. Now he stars in a new Netflix series called Ripley, which is an adaptation of the Patricia Highsmith novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley. He plays Tom Ripley, a con man with no conscience. I think it would be fair to call him a sociopath. After surviving financially on small-time scams, he lands a bigger one when a wealthy man, Mr. Greenleaf, tracks him down with a proposition involving his son, Dickie. Mr. Greenleaf was told that Dickie and Tom Ripley were friends in college. Mr. Greenleaf pays Ripley to go to Italy, where his son has been living with his girlfriend. The mission Ripley is given is to convince Dickie to return home to the U.S. Of course, Ripley accepts the offer, but when he meets Dickie and his girlfriend and looks at Dickie's luxurious home across from the beach, the art on the walls, the fine watches, the elegant clothes in the closet, he wants that life. So he plots a way to impersonate Dickie and claim the riches and the lifestyle for himself. In this scene, Ripley is alone in Dickie's home, trying on Dickie's clothes, and he's pleased to find they fit well, and he looks quite good in them. He's been posing in the mirror, trying to get Dickie's look and his voice. Now he's sitting on the edge of Dickie's bed, pretending to be Dickie, breaking up with Dickie's girlfriend, Marge.
Marge, I'm sorry, but you gotta understand, I don't love you. We're friends. That's all. Come on, don't cry. That's not gonna work, Marge. Stop it. Because you're interfering with Tom and me. No. It's not like that. It's not that. We're not that. No, there's a bond between us. Can you understand that? Or are you just going to keep making accusations? Can you understand anything? Come on, Marge.
It's not that. Andrew Scott, welcome to Fresh Air. You are so terrific. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, pleasure to be here, Terry.
What did you need to know about the mind of Tom Ripley to play him? I mean, is he desperate for money? Is he a sociopath? Do you have to think about what his motivation is?
I did a little. I found all the words like sociopath and psychopath and monster, evil, villain, all those things sort of largely unhelpful. And really, I just kind of thought about the character in stages, and like a lot of Shakespearean characters, when they say when you play a Shakespearean king or something, you don't play the king, everybody else plays the king. So everybody's allowed to be as frightened and intimidated by Tom as they like, and to diagnose him in whatever way they see fit. But for me, I think your first job is to sort of advocate for the character and try not to judge them. And so I tried not to label him too much. And actually a lot of the challenge is to sort of unlearn the stuff we might know from the character's reputation, you know, to yank it back from the possession that the audience sort of has of him. And the,
you mean from the previous film adaptation or from the book?
Yeah, the film adaptations, and to sort of think, okay, well, what do I read when I read these scripts? The scripts were really extraordinary, and, you know, it's an 8-hour adaptation of the novel, so we have a sort of very particular opportunity in this one to spend an inordinate amount of time with a singular character, an opportunity that you don't normally get in television, where you spend so much time with one character. Usually in television it's maybe a couple or a family or a hospital or a police department or whatever.
Your eyes are so interesting in this series, because sometimes they're, you know, a little comical, or but sometimes they are, and sometimes they're kind of threatening, and other times they're just blank, like there's nothing going on.
Yeah,
like they're dead and there's nothing going on behind them. And it strikes me that that must be hard to achieve, since you're not dead inside.
Yes, you know?
You have a conscience. Can you talk a little bit about going into that, like, dead inside blank state?
So it's not necessarily that you would be playing nothing. And I think what's interesting about Tom Ripley is that we're watching this very brilliant person think. And I think that's a great pleasure for an audience to watch a character, particularly an intelligent character, use his brain in a very particular way, and to watch him make mistakes, and to watch him go through all those stages. And so a little bit like what you're talking about, that blankness that might exist in the audience's mind is actually just in the audience's mind, and not necessarily a blankness that I'm you know, consciously trying to conjure up, you know. And so I find that really interesting, the audience participation in performance. And I think some of the most interesting performances where they are where you invite the audience into a kind of complicity with you, you know, and they have to do a little bit of work. And conversely, the kind of less satisfying performances are ones where you think, oh my God, we're being spoon-fed everything here, and we're left in absolutely no doubt as to what we should be thinking.
So you're playing Tom Ripley, somebody who's hiding his real identity and assuming the identity of others. So he's always hiding who he is. You must identify with that in a way as an actor, because you're always playing somebody else. But also, Patricia Highsmith, who wrote the novel that Ripley is adapted from, she was a lesbian and had to hide that, because when she was writing, like, you couldn't be out. There's no way.
Yeah.
And you grew up in Dublin, and I think you were alive when homosexuality was against the law. So, like, she knew stuff about hiding. You knew stuff about hiding, you know, your identity, or you knew people who probably had to hide their identity. So do you feel that sense of hiddenness in the portrayal?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. She's definitely talking about murky times in society, and a lot of the stuff is coded, and there's certainly stuff that she can't speak explicitly about. And I think she uses Tom Ripley as her sort of imp. She really adored the character. And so, yeah, I do understand that feeling of hiding. There's something about this character that to me is quite elusive and possibly just secretive, even to himself.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like he's definitely secretive to himself.
Yeah, there are so many of us, and I think this is the reason why the character is so enduring, that are strangers to ourselves, you know, that we do things that aren't necessarily murderous, but that we do things we think, I have absolutely no idea where that came from, or there's parts of us that are mysterious to ourselves. And I think that's true of Tom. He certainly works as a con artist, and I think he's fluid. He's a kind of fluid character, and he certainly isn't a natural born killer, and he certainly isn't a natural murderer. He doesn't like blood. He's invited to go to this with this task. It's not something that he seeks out himself. But to me, I think a lot of what she's talking about is class. You know, we see this very talented, isolated man who has been given no access to any of the beautiful things in life, despite being extremely gifted. And he lives in a rat-filled boarding house in the Lower East Side. And then he's transplanted to a beautiful country where these very entitled people with half the talent that he has are exposed to everything. And I think a sort of rage emerges in him that he's hitherto sort of unaware of. And I think it also might unearth a sort of sexuality within him, possibly, that he's uncomfortable with, and an envy and a kind of passion.
The film is shot in black and white, and it's really exquisite. Like, every shot could be a beautiful still photograph if you just, you know, stopped it and look at the frame. And I'm wondering what it was like to shoot that way, because just setting up the lighting and the composition, it's so carefully and artfully done.
Mm.
So did that mean a lot of time waiting for you?
It absolutely did. Yeah, it did. Yeah.
And did you have to be aware of exactly how the lighting was so the shadows would fall exactly right?
To a certain extent, I certainly knew that Steve Zalian, our director, was very concerned with you know, how the imagery looked, and he was very fastidious about that. So, yeah, it did involve a lot of waiting around, and one of the challenges of the character is, of course, that he's isolated, and you know, we shot it towards the end of the pandemic, and I certainly think that the atmosphere, you know, on the set and in the world at the time definitely permeated the feeling that I had in the process, and probably in the performance to some degree.
So you may be tired of talking about your role in Fleabag as a priest.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
As a priest torn between your commitment to the priesthood and your love for the main character, the woman nicknamed Fleabag, torn between your commitment to celibacy and your own sexual desire. And, you know, it stars Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who also created and wrote it. And she plays a single woman who really loves sex and has had a lot of partners, but isn't really in love until she meets you. And you're a priest who performs the ceremony for Fleabag's father's second marriage. She falls in love with you. You're drawn to her. But you're a priest. You become good friends, and she started to hope that you'll leave the priesthood and be with her. And I want to play a scene in which she's visiting you at the parish in the evening. And the scene starts inside and then moves outside. So we just did a bit of editing to edit together those two parts of the scene. So let's hear that. Phoebe Waller-Bridge's Fleabag speaks first.
So I read your book.
Okay, great.
Well, it's got some great twists.
True.
But I couldn't help
Come
but
on,
notice just one or two little inconsistencies.
Okay, sure.
So the world was made in 7 days. And on the first day, light came, and then a few days later, the sun came.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
But you believe that?
It's not fact. It's poetry. It's moral code. It's for interpretation to help us work out God's plan for us.
What's God's plan for you?
I believe God meant for me to love people in a different way. I believe I'm supposed to love people as a father.
We can arrange that.
A father of many.
I'll go up to three.
It's not going to happen.
Two, then.
Okay, two.
Do you think I should become a Catholic?
No, don't do that. I like that you believe in a meaningless existence. And you're good for me. You make me question my faith.
And?
I've never felt closer to God.
That's Phoebe Waller-Bridge and my guest, Andrew Scott. That's such a great role and such a great performance. Did you ever know a young priest as attractive as you were?
That's very kind and also impossible to answer. I completely adore Phoebe and...
let's not avoid the question here. We'll take out the comparison to you so you don't have to worry about being humble here. But did you ever know a young, very attractive priest?
No. No, the priests that I knew were not young or attractive.
Right. You were raised Catholic in Dublin. What was the role of the church in your life?
Well, I think it was a huge role in my life growing up. The culture is based on the Catholic Church. Ireland is a small country. I was at a Jesuit school. I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but certainly the culture around Catholicism is one that is very hard to dispel. And parts of it are wonderful. I think the sort of focus on community within the Catholic Church is really wonderful. And there's also, of course, the huge amount of corruption and abuse that happened when I was growing up in the 90s. I remember, driving to school. My father would drive me to school in the mornings and we would listen to the news in the morning. And, you know, my very strong memory is of just a whole litany of abuse cases within the Catholic Church just coming out every morning.
Sexual abuse
and not just sexual abuse, but infidelity within marriages and marriages where people would be, having affairs with priests and, but mainly sexual abuse.
Were you really angry with the church for having so many hypocrites in positions of religious power? You talk about the priests who were accused of sexual abuse and, infidelity and, entering other people's marriages. You're gay. I don't know how old you were when you realized that, maybe all your life. But like I said, in the Republic of Ireland, being gay was against the law until I think 1993. I think that's when it was repealed.
Yeah.
And the church condemned it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you have these priests, abusing boys and having affairs with women and men, probably. So how did you fit all these complicated feelings into your character of the priest in Fleabag? And it's a comedic role, too,
as we could
hear from the scene that we played. And he's wrestling with the natural sexual desire that people
love,
have,
and love. He falls in love.
Physical expressions of love, too.
Yeah. So it's not the abstinence that I have the problem with. It's the silence around the abstinence and the way that people in position of power silence people who want to be able to talk about that. And so the reason that I found that character so cathartic is that, when I first had the conversation with Phoebe, I don't want to play a sort of a stereotype of somebody who is extreme in that way. This is a human being. I think that's why we like that character, because he does have a faith. I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to have romantic feelings and to also have faith and to be able to talk about the human struggle. And so I love the fact that this quite radical sexual kind of risque series has that at its center, a real addressing for young people of what faith is, because I think there's a real gap for people of my generation who have been let down by the church and feel like it's not for them. To have a still space is something that would be wonderful for them if they were made feel welcome. And I think that's perhaps why Fleabag appealed to so many people, because it wasn't cynical. I think we tried to talk about religion and in a humorous way, but also in a way that isn't just too judgmental of the Catholic Church, that actually this is a person who really is struggling and is a human being.
And I love the fact that he questions his faith, but constantly stays with it. And that it's okay to question it.
Absolutely.
If your belief is deep enough, it's okay to challenge it and question it and remain committed.
So, remain committed, exactly. That to see that struggle, like in any relationship, in a marriage, you think, this is tough, this relationship is hard, how do I keep it going? How do I talk about it? It's not just blind devotion the whole time in any relationship. You question it, and it's how you approach those crises that makes us honourable and courageous, and that's a wonderful thing to be able to convey and also, of course, just to address.
Did any priests give you feedback on your role in Fleabag?
Yeah, they did, actually. I had really, really positive feedback from priests. I think because they liked, like all of us, like to see themselves represented in a sort of fair way, and that they're not just these pious, flawless people. I think most of the feedback I got was really, really wonderful.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Scott. He stars in the new Netflix series, Ripley. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Organic Valley, a co-op of small organic family farms. Farmer Tyler Webb shares what being a steward of his land means to him.
When I think of land stewardship, it's taking the opportunity to, like, slowly walk through your farm. To listen.
To look for ways to work in harmony with our environment, with our ecosystem.
Discover Organic Valley Dairy at ov.coop/ethically sourced. This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Support for this podcast comes from the Neubauer Family Foundation, supporting WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation.
Hi there, it's me, Anne-Marie Baldonado, here to tell you about our latest Fresh Air Plus bonus episode.
We were going down the highway, we were somewhere in the South, and there was just pandemonium in the car. My sister and I just had a fit. We really had to pull over and stop the car and settle down. Oh my God, it's Sam, it's Sam.
Yes, that's the Queen of Soul herself, the late Aretha Franklin, talking about her friendship with Sam Cooke. You can hear more of that interview and get all of our episodes sponsor-free by joining Fresh Air Plus for yourself at plus.npr.org.
I want to ask you about your recent film, All of Us Strangers, in which you play a screenwriter in London living in a new high-rise building, and there's only one other unit that seems to have anyone living in it. So it's this shiny and eerily empty new building. The other resident, played by Paul Mescal, turns out to be gay, like your character, and you develop an intimate relationship. At the same time, you return to the town where you were raised, and the people who you meet there are your parents, but we, the audience, don't know that immediately because they're the same age you are. Once we realize, wait, that's his parents, like, I was thinking, like, this is terrible casting. The parents are the same age as the son. What went wrong here? But then you realize the parents were in a car accident when your character was 11 years old. And you've gone back either in your mind or physically to talking with them and trying to bridge the gap of the man you've become, the screenwriter, the man who is gay with the child who they knew, and all the things you couldn't tell them and couldn't talk about then and are just like dying to tell them now. You know, having the conversations you always wish you'd had they been alive. Are your parents still alive?
My mother died 3 weeks ago.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Are you okay?
I'm okay now, as we're speaking. Yeah, I'm okay.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I was going to ask you, and I'm not sure if this is anything you'd care to talk about, knowing now what I know. If you, as you were playing that, wanted to have conversations with your parents that you never had, and now I'm hoping that you had the conversations.
I feel very lucky that I feel that there was nothing that I needed to say to my mum, or I feel there was nothing that she needed to say to me that was left unsaid. So I feel very grateful for that.
Is your father still alive?
Yeah, yeah.
And is he okay?
My father's okay.
All right. One of the things about playing this role, it's one of the films in which you show your ability to be silent and still convey a lot. There's about 14 minutes where the camera is, you know, mostly on you and on your face or you're walking and you don't say a word for like 14 minutes.
Wow, is it really? I think that's really fascinating for audiences to watch. I think audiences love to watch characters think and feel. And, you know, so much of what we say is less important than what we convey. And that's one of the things I love about acting, is that you don't, what you say accounts for certain amount of things, but actually a lot of the time we're saying things while we're feeling some other things. That's the way, that's really representative, I think, of the way human beings behave.
Well, that's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's what happens a lot. It's like, it's just the way we are.
One of my favorite lines in the movie is actually said by Paul Mescal, who says, I was a fat kid, and when you're fat, people don't ask why you don't have a girlfriend. And I thought, like, oh, that gets you so much.
Mm. It's brilliant. It's so truthful. The screenplay was so incredibly truthful, and I love the fact that it sort of, that film has really, I love the fact that the way films are distributed now, that they get to a really, really wide audience, and it's really affected so many different types of people. Because everybody has a relationship with their parents, whether they their parents are alive or not, or whether they are parents themselves. Everybody at some point has a relationship with them, whether they're in their lives or not, or whether they're a parent or not. And I think most people have a relationship with falling in love. And so I love the fact that that film, because it's sort of unusual, there's a dreamlike quality to it, sort of... is able to tap into a huge swathes of different experiences. I think it's really special, that film.
We need to take a short break, so let me reintroduce you. My guest is Andrew Scott. He stars as Tom Ripley in the new Netflix adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley. The series is called Ripley. He played the priest in the series Fleabag. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
I think you first became known in the U.S. in Sherlock, the BBC series that played in the U.S. as well, with Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock Holmes and you as his nemesis, Moriarty. So I want to play a scene from season one, and this is the first scene where Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty meet face to face. And Moriarty has lured Sherlock to rescue his friend Watson, who's been outfitted with an explosive vest. So Sherlock is pointing a gun at you during this entire exchange, and your character, Moriarty, speaks first.
Do you know what happens if you don't leave me alone, Sherlock? To you?
Oh, let me guess. I get killed.
Kill you? No, don't be obvious. I mean, I'm going to kill you anyway someday. I don't want to rush it, though. I'm saving it up for something special. No. If you don't stop prying, I'll burn you. I will burn the heart out of you.
I have been reliably informed that I don't have one.
But we both know that's not quite true. Well, I'd better be off. Well, so nice to have had a proper chat.
What if I was to shoot you now, right now?
Then you could cherish the look of surprise on my face. Because I'd be surprised, Sherlock, really I would. I'm just a teensy bit disappointed. And of course, you wouldn't be able to cherish it for very long. Child, Sherlock Holmes.
Catch you later.
No, you won't.
So you play Moriarty, big and smirky, sinister and funny. What was your audition like?
My audition was incredibly fun. Just the day before, I knew that they were auditioning people to play Moriarty, and their original idea was that this character would appear almost like just an image, and it would say something like, "Hello, Sherlock," and that would be the end of the series. But then when they realized that lots of actors coming into audition just saying "Hello, Sherlock" doesn't give them much of an idea of the actor's range, you know, for future series if they cast this actor. So they quickly wrote, Stephen Moffat, the writer, quickly wrote that scene, which eventually appeared as the scene we've just listened to, as an audition scene for actors to read in the audition. And they sent it maybe, I don't know, like the night before the audition, and I thought, wow, this is really fun. And I was aware that I didn't look like a villain at the time. I had quite a sort of, you know, boyish face and stuff. And so I took great pleasure in frightening them. And I knew in the audition that they were amused, but also that they were scared.
Were you able to tap into a place in yourself that you thought could scare people?
Yeah. I was. I feel like one of the things that I feel quite fortunate about is that I feel quite near my emotions, you know. I feel that's stood me in good stead as an actor. I feel like it's an enormously, it feels healthy to me to be able to access that part of you but not really do any harm, you know. Yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it, to be an actor?
Yeah. I want to move on to Hamlet. You got an Olivier Award, I think, right, for your portrayal?
I might have. Yeah,
you might have. Okay.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to know if you don't know?
Yeah, well, I don't know. How am I supposed to know if you don't know?
Well, anyways, you were acclaimed.
Yeah.
Okay.
You were acclaimed. People liked it. Yeah. People liked it. Yeah. So
you've spoken about how you wanted to make the language understandable. Cause so often, especially for Americans who sometimes have to work hard just to grasp a British accent when spoken quickly or spoken with a regional British accent. And of course, so much of the language in Shakespeare is language that we no longer use. It's archaic. But you really wanted to make every word understandable. So I went on YouTube to see if I could find anything, and I found you doing part of the "to be or not to be" soliloquy, which is, of course, the most famous part. And it was so interesting because, you know, Hamlet is really like thinking through, like, should I live or should I end my life? I don't know. And what's the worst that can happen if I die? What would that be like? And of course, he's using very elevated poetic language to say all of that. But you say it like really slowly. There are so many like long pauses in between, for instance, "to be," long pause, or "not to be." And on the one hand, I felt like, wow, that's a lot of pauses. And on the other hand, I felt like, well, every word is ringing out. And I'm kind of hearing things I hadn't heard before. So can you describe your thoughts about those pauses and why you took them and where you took them?
I suppose the thing about the pauses is that he's thinking, am I going to live or am I going to die? And we're seeing that live. And, you know, your job is to not play the famous speech. Your job is to just, that speech wasn't written to be famous. It was just written to be authentic. And this is somebody who's thinking, am I going to do this? Or am I not going to do this? And nobody's watching him. So why wouldn't he take his time? You know, a lot of the language is archaic, but a lot of words that we still use today were invented by Shakespeare. So I have this real passion about Shakespeare that it shouldn't be kidnapped by academics. It's something that's very actable. And for young actors, if you really examine it and you're not intimidated and you're not told this isn't for you, then actually it should be really, really accessible. And you may not understand every single word, but in the same way you may not understand or get every word in a rap song, you understand that there's a musicality to it and there's a feeling that you have to get, and that could be witty or it could be contemplative or it could be whatever it is. And it's incredibly actable. And also Hamlet is incredibly funny. And so it was just, like with all things, it's just to be able to ignore the famousness of the play. In fact, we had a thing in rehearsal called the famous play buzzer, where you're like, are we just doing this just because everybody knows this is what you would do? Like, Hamlet's father appears to him as a ghost at the beginning of the story. And we don't know, we should unlearn the fact that we don't know that that character could be in that character who only appears fleetingly. We know that probably because we know the play so well that actually that he just appears to him and then he goes for the majority of the play. But for a 16-year-old who's watching it, they don't know that this character isn't going to be by his side for the rest of the show. So you have to unlearn what you already know about the famousness of the play, in the same way you have to unlearn all the stuff that you know about Tom Ripley and or James Moriarty or anything that when you're reinterpreting, a famous story. So I found all that really interesting, and all the stuff about Hamlet to me is fascinating, because people say, oh, he's the dark prince and he's wearing, the inky black cloak and blah, blah, blah. But actually, this is just a guy, which I very much understand at the moment, which is a guy who's in mourning. His father has died very, very recently. So the question is, that you don't drown that character in just, oh, he's just a dark, depressing guy. Where was his lightness? And so I feel like you always have to go towards the lightness when you're dealing with tragedy. And a little bit like Fleabag, then when you're dealing with comedy, you have to look for the soul. And that's what I think the great art, or certainly the art that I am interested in, has a bit of both, because that's the way we are as human beings. We like a bit of both. We laugh on the saddest day of our life, and we cry in the middle of a brunch when we don't think we're going to. It's always within us all the time, the potential to go in either direction.
Andrew Scott, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. And your face changes from role to role. Can you pass unrecognized on the street?
I can, yeah. Yeah, I can. Sometimes.
Right, sometimes. Yeah, do you use depends any kind of disguise or?
It depends. I'm very lucky. I can walk the streets pretty easily,
Yeah, we'll see how long that lasts.
I've been saying that for a while, so hopefully I'll be able to duck and dive into the future.
Well, congratulations on Ripley, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andrew Scott stars in the new Netflix series Ripley, an adaptation of the Patricia Highsmith novel The Talented Mr. Ripley. After we take a short break, the forerunner of music videos, Soundies, 3-minute music performances on film. There's a new collection of Soundies from the 1940s. This is Fresh Air.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
Decades before there were music videos, there were Soundies. In the 1940s, you could not only listen to your favorite bands and vocalists on records or the radio, but you could also watch musical numbers on a Soundie. Fresh Air's classical music critic Lord Schwartz guesses that unless you caught a soundie between feature films on Turner Classic Movies or one of them popped up on YouTube, you probably wouldn't know about them. But now you have a chance to see lots of them as collected on a four-disc Blu-ray set called Soundies: The Ultimate Collection, released by Kino Classics. Here's Lloyd's review.
No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. A misbehaving, saving all my love for you. You fine rascal, you. I know for certain the one I love. I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. A misbehaving, saving all my love for you, just you. Like Jack Horner in a corner, don't go nowhere. What do I care? Your kisses, my dear, are worthwhile waiting for. Believe me, dear.
Fats Waller accompanied himself in his great song, Ain't Misbehavin', on recordings, on the radio, and in the movies. But the clip we just heard was actually the soundtrack of a soundie, one of the more than 1,800 three-minute musical films made in the 1940s, which you could watch in a bar or club when you dropped a dime into a Panorama, a large jukebox with a screen. These soundies were a short-lived phenomenon that bridged the chronological gap between radio and television, but they presented a surprisingly complex image of American life, including race and gender. You can now sample them on a big new Blu-ray set called Soundies: The Ultimate Collection, intelligently curated by film historian Susan Delson. Many of the performers on Soundies were pop music royalty: Duke Ellington and Count Basie, Cab Calloway and Gene Krupa, Anita O'Day, the Mills Brothers, and Sister Rosetta Tharpe, a singer equally at home in gospel and hot jazz. Though most of the Soundies musicians never became household names. But some of them were taking their baby steps toward future stardom. In a Soundie called A Latin from Staten Island, a handsome guitar player identified simply as Ricardo marked the very first screen appearance of leading man Ricardo Montalban. Nat King Cole, Spike Jonze, and 50s sitcom queen Gail Storm made Soundies early in their careers. It's a trip watching a 24-year-old pianist with wavy hair and a broad smile named Walter Liberace racing his fleet fingers double time over a mirrored keyboard in Tiger Rag. The first African-American performer to appear in Soundies was a vivacious young singer and dancer named Dorothy Dandridge, whose hips, shoulders, and eyes seemed to move in many different directions at the same time. A decade later, she became the first black artist to be nominated for an Oscar in a leading role. One of my favorite Soundies features Dandridge and her loose-limbed singing and dancing partner, Paul White, in an irresistible number called A Zoot Suit. Soundies were a veritable encyclopedia of 40s lingo.
I want a suit, suit with a replete, with the draper shape and a stuff cuff to look sharp enough. See my sunny gal. I want a reeve sleeve with the right stripe and a dress vest with the glad plaid in the latest fad. See my sunny gal. I want to look keen, so my dream will say, you don't look like same bow. So keen that she'll scream, ow! Here comes my walking rainbow. So make a suit, suit with a reeve. Please, I want the drape shape and a stuff cuff to look sharp enough to see my sunny gal.
I want a brown gown with a zop top with a hip slip, a lace waist in the sharpest taste. See my sunny man. I want a scat hat with a trim brim, a zag bag with a rip zip to look plenty hip to see my Sunday Sam. Yes, I want to look keen, so my dream will say, ain't I the lucky fella? So keen that he'll scream, baby, you sure look mellow. So
make a curator Susan Delson arranges this collection into a variety of social activities, especially dancing and the war effort, and categories of music, including such bizarre hybrids as the hula rumba and cowboy calypso. Most soundies were made with white performers, but Delson readjusts the balance so that almost a quarter of the soundies here feature black performers. Soundies were largely ignored by Hollywood's strict production code, so some of them are delightfully raunchy. One of the rare soundies caught in the crosshairs of the censors was the 1941 Shoeshiners and Headliners, from which 18 seconds were cut from general release, but shown complete here. Two rows of dancers back to back, white women and black men, seemed to come a little too close to touching. In the end, soundies were a mixed bag. Low budgets were a serious limitation, though also inspired surprising visual invention. Many soundies were purely war propaganda, singing commercials for war bonds or boosters for women in the workplace, ominous warnings against talking to spies, or racist jabs at our adversaries. But the best of them, like this one with Gene Krupa, Anita O'Day, and trumpeter Roy Eldridge, are musical treasures.
Hey, Joe.
What do you mean, Joe? My name's Roy.
Well, come here, Roy, and get groovy. You been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown, but I've been around.
You mean to say you ain't been uptown?
No, I haven't been uptown. What's uptown?
Pleasure you're about, and you feel like stepping out. Oh, you've got to shout, let me off uptown. If it's rhythm that you feel, then it's nothing to conceal.
Lloyd Schwartz's most recent book is called Who's On First? New and Selected Poems. He reviewed Soundies, the ultimate collection, released by Kino Classics. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality. We talk with Amanda Montell about her new book. She's a linguist known for her sense of humor and for her books, Word Slut and Cultish, and her podcast, Sounds Like a Cult. I hope you'll join us. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.
Anita, oh Anita. Say, I feel something.
What you feel, Roy? The heat?
No, it ain't the heat. It must be that uptown rhythm. Because I feel like blowing.
Well, blow, Roy, blow!
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.